Blog.
Hello and welcome to Inside Scoop Live, the live audio program brought to you by ReaderFuse.com. I'm your host, Juanita Watson, and today I've invited on the program author Kay Williams to talk about her new book, which she co-authored with Eileen Wyman, titled Butcher of Dreams. This is a suspense thriller novel, and it's their first collaboration. Kay Williams is a professional actress who has played leading roles at regional theaters around the U.S., including the San Francisco Actors Workshop and the Pittsburgh Playhouse. Among her many credits are the title role in Miss Jarius, Sybil in The Great God Brown, and Georgette in The Balcony, all plays that are part of the repertory in the 42nd Street Theater in their new novel, Butcher of Dreams. She has also performed in many, many new plays off-Broadway in Manhattan and knows how difficult it is for new, talented playwrights to get produced and talented new actors to get noticed. She has acted in radio, television, and film, and for several years she worked behind the scenes as assistant producer with an award-winning independent filmmaker in New York. Kay is also co-author of One Last Dance, an award-winning novel started by her father, Mardo Williams, and finished by her and her sister, Jerry Lawrence. Now, the other half of this writing duo, Eileen Wyman, began her multifaceted career in radio and television. Her first love is comedy, and she has spent her life learning the art and craft of it. Eileen has crafted jokes for speechwriters and comedians, humorous fillers for various magazines, and captions for cartoonists. She can come up with a witty retort at the snap of a finger. She is a writer of short fiction, has edited many books and film scripts, and has written additional dialogue for film. During her long career, Eileen has held a variety of odd jobs to make ends meet, including teacher, social worker, and office temp. When she grows up, she wants to be either a wizard or a world-class tennis player. Well, that sounds like an interesting story. I wish we had Eileen on the phone today, but we've only got Kay Williams, which is fantastic. Welcome to Inside Scoop Live, Kay.
Well, it's great to be here.
Well, thank you. Oh, congratulations on the publication of your novel, Butcher of Dreams.
Well, we're really excited about it, and we've gotten, you know, lots of nice feedback, and some readers' groups are reading it and discussing it, and that's nice.
Mm-hmm, of course. Well, tell us how your collaboration with Eileen Wyman came about.
Well, actually, we've been friends for a number of years in Ohio, and then our lives took us, you know, in different areas, but we did meet up with one another here in the city, and she'd had a varied career, and I had too, and we both had just moved into this neighborhood, which was pretty raunchy at the time, near the Hudson River, and it was actually very scary, but it was housing for performing artists, and acting jobs for me were kind of drying up, and so we thought, well, we were having dinner and a glass of wine, why not try to collaborate on a suspense novel? We thought that would be the easiest kind to get published and use this seamy neighborhood we were living in.
Mm-hmm.
And so we decided to tackle it. Of course, it was one of those things that sounded very nice over dinner and wine, but
sure,
the reality of doing it was something else. We tried our hand first at a couple of short stories independently and then together and felt we really could sustain a longer narrative.
Mm.
And, of course, my background in theater, I had, kind of my forte would be like in the character development and in the narrative line and the plot kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And Eileen's would be more like if we needed a humorous tidbit to break it up or a kind of pithy description. Or many times when we were working together, I would say, hey, we need something to break this up, and I would read her something, and right off the top of her head, she'd come up with a retort that was really right on.
Oh, that's great.
But, you know, as we started very slowly and had to map out the whole thing and naturally, we wanted it to be a theater story because both of our backgrounds.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to use the neighborhood. And
mm-hmm.
you always have to decide on point of view and which character. So we thought point of view would be good to be from the viewpoint of this very vulnerable, but actually, you know, sensitive and tough in a way, this woman who is an actress and gets this theater kind of thrown into her lap as administrator, although she wants to act more than she's being allowed to that first year.
And this is Lee Fairchild?
Yeah, Lee Fairchild, right. We thought it would be good to be from the single point of view, almost a single point of view. You have her,
mm-hmm.
who is thrown into this situation, and then you have the very menacing voiceover of someone that starts right at the beginning of the book, and you aren't quite sure what this person or thing or whatever
mm-hmm.
has in mind, and you just know that it's very scary, and it's something she doesn't really know, that she is in jeopardy or the theater is in jeopardy until things begin to escalate. The whole, well, I'm getting into the plot, but so we knew how we wanted the book to begin.
Yeah.
And we knew how we wanted it to end. And, of course, in between, we had a whole lot of stuff we had to map out. And usually, well, I guess people work differently on books. I always think of it as an image like you're trying to sweep a thick carpet and there's a big roll in the middle and you just keep pushing and pushing to tie up loose ends along the way.
Mm-hmm.
But we were lucky after about the first four chapters, we decided we needed someone outside of us to get some input. And luckily through the Mystery Writers of America, we found a wonderful writers group. So we were able to run 10 pages at a time. We'd meet every week with them and hear their stuff, and they'd hear ours. And they would be like a reader, you know, like, well, I don't know why that bothered me, or I believe, you know, this is too much, or I really like that. So it was really great to have that kind of feedback. So
mm-hmm. It's great to be able to bounce ideas off a group like that when you're in the process of writing.
Right, right. But because we knew each other so well, I think it was, I don't know how it would be to collaborate with someone you didn't know, like, say, a publisher. You know, well, why don't you be a ghostwriter or collaborate with so-and-so? I think that would be tough, but we knew each other very well. We could get together. I would usually do a first pass, and then she would make comments, or if we were working together, I would run things by her and get an immediate, you know, vocal reply, and then we would show it to, you know, read it to the group, and then get their suggestions, make more revisions, and just, you know, go on from there.
Mm-hmm.
So it really worked out better than we had envisioned. What started as pie in the sky really became a reality. It took a long time.
Mm. How long did it take?
Well, because life always enters in. I mean, it took several years because we both had full-time jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So many times I would get up at 4 in the morning, work on stuff and leave it for her, and then we would get feedback in the evening. But we usually found then you got too revved up, you couldn't go to back to sleep.
Right,
so.
Right, especially a thriller,
And then reading it to the group and revising, and then once you get the whole thing, you have other readers. And then, as I say, it's slow going if you don't have full-time days full-time to work on it. You know, I think your peak creative period, maybe 2 to 3 hours, but of course there's always research that you have to do
mm-hmm.
and other things that take up a lot of time. But by having a 9-to-5 job, it really does interfere with your time to work on it. And then during the time, of course, you have your parents becoming ill and, you know, just all these things you have to attend to.
Sure.
And then after my mother had a very long illness, and finally I got to come back to it after about a year. So you have to get reacquainted
mm-hmm.
with the whole material again. And so it was a lengthy process. And then in the meantime, my dad was a newspaper man. We didn't, you know, want him to kind of fall by the wayside after my mom died. So we got him writing a book about his mother, our grandmother, who lived to be 110. So then I kind of took over the reins of that, and so it was a while.
You got lots on your plate, Kay.
Right, right. But I think that's it. If you really are a writer, you know, you just have to be tenacious.
Yes, absolutely. So let's talk a little bit about the setting of Butcher of Dreams, because this novel takes place in Hell's Kitchen, New York, which is actually where you still live,
right.
But it takes place in 1980s Hell's Kitchen, which is very different than what we're seeing today. So tell us about the Hell's Kitchen of the 1980s that's in your novel.
Well, actually, when Manhattan Plaza for Performing Artists opened up, it's between 9th and, oh, actually there are two buildings, 9th Avenue and 10th Avenue buildings. They're very close to the river. When I came over to look at it, to see if I wanted to consider moving into it from where I lived, the cabbie actually warned me,
mm-hmm.
don't live in this neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
There were gangs over near the river, there were homeless, the crazies had all been let out on the street, you know, and were roaming the streets, sleeping in cardboard boxes over by the river.
Mm-hmm.
There were small theaters in the neighborhood, because that's where artists always go to these kind of neighborhoods, because they don't have much money for rent and
sure.
upkeep. So Times Square was very seedy, and we were just, you know, two blocks from Times Square. There were a lot of porno shops as I say, the homeless and crack cocaine was being sold openly. And so, you know, people would come from all areas to deal in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And there were murders while we lived here earlier, but we thought it would be, a great place of menace for this book, because actually the menace that seemed so consuming outside of the theater was not as... as rampant as the menace inside the theater, you know, as the actors in this league, you know, come to find out
mm-hmm.
that it's someone within the theater complex that people know and trust that could be doing this.
Mm-hmm.
So then I think the late 90s, when Disney finally came in and with the Amsterdam Theater and renovated that old theater and actually moved it. I came by on the bus one day when I saw this building moving. I thought, what is this?
Oh, my God.
It was being moved down to where it is now. And then they brought, you know, The Lion King in, which was a huge success. And then they brought in their stores, and gradually all the bad people, you know, gravitated to another part of town, but they had left this part of town.
Mm-hmm.
Now we even have a Starbucks in our building.
Oh, wow.
Which you can see how upscale we've become.
Very different than back in the day. So tell us what happens in Butcher of Dreams. We've got the atmosphere, the setting. Tell us what happens in this novel.
Well, we have Lee, who's realized every actor's dream, a theater of her own, gosh, she's just on cloud nine. She and someone who's been a friend for a number of years, although she hasn't seen him for a while, put together a grant package.
Mm-hmm.
He would be an artistic director. She would be an administrator more than an actor their first year, but hoping to be able to make the money, get the accolades to really... move the theater into a spot eventually, and they do get a grant for 2 years. Well, just before the season, and it's a repertory theater, which is really an anomaly in New York City. At the time we started this, there was one repertory theater here, the Mirror Rep, that had a name actress, Geraldine Page, with it, but they live from hand to mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And so I know a repertory theater is a hard thing to maintain, especially in New York City. I thought that would be really great, because it is a rep theater is every actor's dream, too.
Mm-hmm.
So, but just before the theater, the season opens, Lee's husband, who's a middle-aged man, a youngish man, dies of a heart attack, and she's devastated, a very vulnerable state. It was a big surprise, just suddenly. Her daughter, who's 18, goes away to college. She's all alone. She lives not in New York City, but in a suburb. She can drive to about 45 minutes away. So she is wondering if she's up to this. She's, in, as I say, in this vulnerable state when the season begins in September, October. Well, right off the bat, a homeless derelict is found dead in the on the third floor, where that's where construction and storage is. Not the theater part of the theater where the stage is, but it's where the offices are on the second floor, and this is on the third floor where they construct the set. He's found dead. No one seems to know how he got in. The theater is supposed to be locked. So they speculate on how he got in. And then they find, the police are called, they find that his ring finger has been cut off, which is kind of weird, but the detective says maybe someone wanted his, you know, a ring that he had that was valuable.
Okay.
So then they just kind of, the police say it's a suspicious death because he might have gotten in there and died of a drug overdose, too. They aren't quite sure how he died. Well, from that, things really begin to escalate. They have a cast party after the first play at Lee's home where a ritual Aztec mask that people have been kind of playing with throughout the evening once they discover it. At the end of the party, they discover the mask has been stolen. And it's Lee has thought about that mask from time to time. It had just been acquired not too long before the theater opened by her husband when they all went on a trip to Mexico. And supposedly it had an ancient Aztec curse. Mm-hmm. The Indian said who sold it to them, they poo-pooed it because it really was an eye-catching kind of thing. So the mask is stolen and by someone from, you know, who was at the cast party. And it seems like then things really go from bad to worse. An actress is poisoned, an actor is stabbed, there are strange markings, strange things happen at the theater, and Lee herself finally had an encounter with a mysterious masked figure, actually. He's wearing the stolen mask and a costume from one of the plays, and does survive, but then she knows that, for sure, it's not just random violence happening to them.
Mm-hmm.
It's someone within the group.
Something's happening. Where did the idea for the Aztec mask and this curse come from? And this mask is actually the one that's on the front cover of the book. It's brilliant.
Well, actually, it isn't on the front cover.
Oh, it's not?
No. That is another mask. The person who designed the cover was shown the original one that was used, but everyone felt it was too busy. I mean, it is really weird and eerie.
So there is a real mask.
There is. But this doesn't have all the detail.
Okay.
It just would. We wanted something that would really send a quick, you know, lethal kind of message when people looked at it.
Sure, it does.
So, I'm sorry, we got off on that.
Yeah, no, where did the whole idea for the Aztec mask come from?
Oh, the Aztec.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we started doing some research. I don't know how much to say without giving it away.
Oh, okay.
We did a little research in that direction, and once, of course, we had the mask hanging on her wall, when the other actors try it on and play with it, and, you know, one of them says, oh, the mask just took me over, that's when the idea kind of generated that, oh, hey, we ought to use that in the book and have people be uncertain. Is it really a supernatural tale? Or, as Detective Green says later, well, that kind of thing is only as powerful as your own belief, you know.
Sure.
But, and as we did more research on the Aztec aspect, we found a very interesting cult, the cult of the animal protector. I'm not going to say any more than that. But
oh, you're not? I was going to ask you about that.
We thought that, well, actually, it's just that these, I guess, certain people believe that an animal is a protector of it. It's called that animal which you own. And it could be a dog, I guess, or a wolf or a bird. And it becomes one of those, I guess, fixations. Again, your mind is a very powerful instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And if this is an animal that you own, you feel it gives you the gift, perhaps, of being invisible, you know, and I mean, which is all poppycock, but, you know, again, it can allow you to to go in places that maybe you wouldn't go without that.
Okay.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Amazon recently introduced Kindle, a revolutionary ebook reader that has outpaced expectations in sales. This is a sign that more people are turning to the digital delivery system of books as the practice of digital downloads spread. Let us help you get your printed book or ebook available for instant purchase on Amazon Kindle. You set your own price and collect 35% of list price on each sale. We will upload your book and optimize it for the best performance on Kindle. Please go to readerviews.com and link on the Services for Authors tab on the top menu bar. There you will find a link for more information on how we can upload your book for Kindle viewing today. Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm speaking with Kay Williams, co-author of Butcher of Dreams, which is available through local and online booksellers. As well, you can find out more through Kay's website, calliopepress.com. So who was it that had the idea or that is into anthropology or ancient cultures? Are both of you, or did one of you bring that thread to this novel?
Well, my day job after I decided to quit acting and earn a living was at NYU Medical Center in the Division of Primary Care. And actually, I went to a lot of talks they had, and my boss was board certified in both medicine and psychiatry, so I read a lot of his psychiatry books, for one thing, on the subject of the kind of person we're dealing with. And as far as medical anthropology, there was a wonderful speaker at one of the things I attended down there on that subject, not on the Mexican mask, but just on, psychosomatic illness and what the mind can cause the body, what can do to cause the body to behave in a certain way. So that kind of gave us this idea. And then we thought that, of course, there are so many different ethnicities in the city. It's not like living in Ohio where I grew up, although I think there are more and more probably in every place across the country now. And we both thought that it must be really wrenching for someone who lives in another country to have a corrupt government come into play and have their land stolen, their money stolen, or there is a political coup and they have to flee for their lives and really uproot themselves and move, and most of them move to America, and to be able to survive and to earn a living, which they send back there. But their mores, their traditions, are very strong in them, and they must feel very torn. And that was an aspect we wanted to deal with.
Interesting. So that was right from the beginning, you knew that you wanted to take that
yes.
to the story. Oh, wow.
And the more we did the research, of course, the more we found out, well, this is fascinating, we've got to use
yep.
this. And, of course, we need a medical anthropologist to interpret things along the way.
Yeah. That's great. You know, so one thing that really stands out about this novel as well is the very eclectic cast of characters, and I'm sure you guys had a great time in the writing process coming up with all of these. And I imagine that your own experience in theater and film, you know, combined gave you a complete endless supply of ideas. So tell us a little bit about that, the characters.
Well, we've met many temperamental actors with overblown egos, and of course there's always the actor with the heart of gold. In fact, I think that actors have this, they may act terrible one moment and childishly, but on another, if someone is down in their luck, they come through, as I say, this heart of gold to help out people. And of course they're very empathetic. They can see all sides, as they should to a character. I mean, if someone had to play Hitler, they would find a real human being beneath the atrocity. And of course, we knew actors who lived alternate lifestyles, again, coming from a very sheltered Midwest. I was shocked when I got into the business, but they...
I bet you were.
They were just really nice people.
Yeah.
You know, so you... And artistic. They had talent. So it was fun to work with them. And then, of course, we knew brilliant but erratic directors and playwrights. I remember one place where I worked, there was another theater company, not the one I was with. You know, they were talking about the needles left behind in bathrooms, and so there's always that kind of problem. But we knew that they would really make unforgettable characters, and characters easy to be suspicious of.
Mm-hmm.
But I always like, and Eileen does too, you know, you meet some, you know, just like in real life it happens, you meet someone, you think, I love that person. And then as you get to know them, you find, oh, no, gee, I am
not
really,
so much.
Yeah. Not so, and on the other hand, you meet people you dislike immediately
mm-hmm.
and or find very annoying or whatever. And then as you get to know them and find it, you find, hey, okay, it's because of this. And then you become very tight, very good friends. So we wanted to create people like this where the reader would be uncertain and maybe they would dislike someone, but really learn to like them as the person changed throughout the arc of the book, and again, to dislike other people whom they like from the first. And we, of course, used, combinations of characters from a variety of people we had met in the theater and outside the theater, like Alan Dunbar, the artistic director, lots of my experience. He was based really quite a bit on a director I knew when I was working in San Francisco who was marvelous, but had his own little quirks.
Mm-hmm.
And Ernst Kromer, the other director who's very rigid and a tyrant. I had also, in another theater company, worked with someone like that who was... he also, like Ernst Kromer, had worked with the Berliner Ensemble and had this European way of handling actors, which was more like puppets. You know, we're all American actors are so used to finding things on the inside and letting the character flow out. Well, he was one of those. I think a lot of British actors work very work this way, where he would like try to superimpose a gesture of his on you, which... You know, every show I saw where the actor took that, it looked like they were mimicking someone, not doing a real job as a characterization. So
okay. Yeah.
I thought it would be interesting to put those problems into the book. And then I always found, too, that psychiatrists were really some of the quirkiest, funniest people I'd ever met. You know, finding them down where I work at NYU.
Mm-hmm.
And so thought that Walter would be have his little... eccentricities that could be quite amusing and also would make people suspicious. We also worked with performers who were compulsive practical jokers and some people, some guys who would married but would come on to everyone that they met. So kind of like Barry is. So, and then in my writers group, actually, in our writers group, we had a former police lieutenant who from New York City who had studied law and at the time he was starting to become a legal aid lawyer. So he was wonderful at providing lots of detail about the detective in the story,
mm-hmm.
Mordecai Green. You know, is this believable or not? And we'd love to run things by him. But also we got interviews. At that time, the South Manhattan precinct was right across the street from us, so he arranged we could go over and talk to detectives over there, and it was really a lot of fun. You got to see how dumpy it looked on the inside of the building,
yeah.
and how cynical they were. I mean, nothing surprised them, nothing.
Oh, I'm sure. Mm-hmm.
So we thought, well, we can be as bizarre as we want to be. They won't think. They'll say, okay, it's all in a day's work.
Yeah, right. So is New York still kind of the creative epicenter of theater work?
Well, I guess I like to think it is, although I've been more in the writing game nowadays.
You've been
nowadays.
Out for a while. Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. I think it's really, really tough these days to, I mean, what really works here these days seems to be a big, overblown musical. that costs millions and zillions of dollars and has to be an instant hit. All the wonderful, when I first came to the city, there was a lot of electricity, a lot of really avant-garde things were going on. It was really like an actor's dream at that time, and it was possible to get funding for off-Broadway shows in which you would get a small weekly salary. It would be a contract job through Actors Equity, and it would lead to unemployment benefits. So you really felt like, and it might lead to an agent discovering you or a producer wanting to move it to a larger venue with more money or that kind of thing. It seemed to me that there was a lot more of that going on then than now.
Less opportunity now, I would imagine, for actors.
That's my feeling. Because everything has to be a mega hit, whether it's a book, a play, a movie, you know.
Down to how much it makes at this point.
Yeah, the bottom line is the big, unfortunately.
Yeah. I actually have heard that you are thinking of writing a screenplay for Butcher of Dreams.
Well, you know, it's a matter of having enough time. We started on our sequel to Butcher.
Mm-hmm.
However, I was told by this readers group I participated in about 2 weeks ago that it would make a great movie because it is so visual, and some of the supernatural or things that aren't supernatural you think maybe supernatural would be good. And actually, I think we could do a pretty good job because we know the material so well. And I worked before I took my job at NYU with an award-winning filmmaker who had done both fiction films and nonfiction. And I had really worked with him. We shot one film here in New York City, and we took it to the Cannes Film Festival. We had a villa on the Mediterranean for a month.
Oh, nice.
And then another one of his that was nonfiction was invited to the Leningrad Film Festival just before it became St. Petersburg, and that became the inspiration for the sequel to Butcher of Dreams.
Oh.
So we have some background in film, and we thought it would be fun to try to do a film script. You know, the book we have on a website saying it's available, but I think these days most film companies want it available not as a book in book form, but really as a script.
Yeah.
So I think we might drop everything and do it. I don't know.
Who knows? Maybe after the sequel. What's the sequel to Butcher of Dreams? What's it called?
Well, I don't know.
Like
with Butcher of Dreams, we went through, I don't know, 3 or 4 titles till we came up with something. We don't even have a working title for it.
Mm-hmm.
All we know is it will start in Leningrad in 1991 when the city really is falling apart. You know, Glasnost started in 1986 or something. And when we went over there, it was the first time I'd been there. It was chaotic.
Oh, is that right?
In fact, the festival itself almost canceled 2 weeks before we came because they couldn't even get, I think at that time, Russia had devalued the ruble, and they couldn't even have enough money to print, you know, the listing of the shows that were going to be there, and they didn't know if they'd have enough money to pay for hotels and everything for all of us. So there was that element. You know, everyone wanted hard currency, and the crime was just beginning. Like, I had heard that some members of our group, after I got back home, had been robbed at knife point by a cabbie, for instance.
Oh, my gosh.
And others were practically strip-searched when they took the train from Leningrad into Helsinki. And the KGB was kind of monitoring these the KGB, which was supposed to not be viable, was kind of at the square where people sold these Matryoshka dolls that had, at that time, Gorbachev was the top one. It all went, and then it went down to Peter the Great being the smallest one, kind of saying, no matter glasnost or not, they're all alike here. So there was a very menacing quality to it. Also, the people that we met at the festival were so full of hope for the first time and so nice that it was just an emotional 8 days. And after we made fast friends, all of us who were there, and tried to send cash back to them, you know, FedEx cash that they needed, hard currency, but then we found out it was being intercepted and stolen.
Yeah,
candy, makeup, you know, all these things we tried to get to them because they had nothing. The long line, there were long lines for vodka. Everyone was becoming a drunk. Long lines for bread. And there were just, you know, so many possibilities for people, which was the start of the Russian mafia here, actually. I think people at that time were streaming out, trying to get out as fast as they could, and coming into Brighton Beach here in the city and getting into these, like, Medicare scams and all these scams to
make some money.
Yep, to get some money.
So this the sequel, then, is this featuring Lee? It's set in Leningrad, but is it featuring Lee?
Well, it will start out with Lee's daughter, Heather, who by now has graduated from college. She started out wanting to be an actress, but one of her part-time jobs, she got hooked up with this film director. And so she's there, and she's thinking more and more of really going into film and trying to find something meaningful to say, perhaps in the documentary area, about the plight of women. And, of course, she finds that the women in Russia are really harking back to another time, you know, probably like in American history. I mean, they have no rights. They're, you know, it's 1991, badly treated many times by husbands or boyfriends. And she gets involved. And then after the 8 days are over, comes back to the city. We see what's happening with Lee and the rep company, which is still managing to survive miraculously enough. The neighborhood hasn't gentrified to that extent. And then, interestingly enough, whatever has happened over there seems to follow her back here.
Okay.
You know, with the Russian connections in Brighton Beach and that kind of thing. And so she finally, you know, gets an answer to some of the things. Of course, by this time, we haven't decided for sure, probably Lee and Mordecai Green are an item. Detective Green. Because he moonlighted as an actor in Butcher, and could be by this time he's only working part-time with the police department, or maybe he's full-time with the theater. We haven't quite ironed that out yet. You know, there are some things that need to be decided.
Sure.
We could bounce from the film world to the theater world.
How fun. You guys must just have a great time collaborating on these novels.
Well, it is fun when it really starts, you know, working well. It's a lot of hard kind of slugfesting. Not that we get into yelling matches, but you know, like we come up with our own ideas, and it takes some time to cool down. And sometimes it's good to have the writers group. If you have five people in the group and two of them say the same thing that one of you is thinking, then you know maybe you got to change things.
Okay, let's mention your website.
Okay, well, we're on the www. Calliope Press, that's spelled with a C, CalliopePress.com, and there are a few books listed there. You can click on Butcher of Dreams and get to our website. Also, you can click on One Last Dance, which is a book I collaborated on, my dad started, find out more about it. But on the Butcher of Dreams website, people will find comments about the book from reviewers and readers, and we'll see the author's pictures now and earlier, and bios, find an excerpt, ordering information. I think it's a direct link like to Amazon.com, but it's available on all of the online book sites, and of course can be ordered through
locally.
A regular bookstore library.
Sure.
There are suggested book discussion questions because you know, there are a lot of book groups these days, and a lot of them read mysteries or suspense thrillers as well as, you know, regular books and discuss them. So we have the questions. And
it's a great addition to a website.
Yeah, right, because I think there are a lot of things to discuss, probably in most books, because I think people take, when they read a book, they have very interesting secretive ideas that maybe they're loath to share with people that they believe, you know, and it's not like the critics, well, we don't want chaos in the field of criticism, so this means this and this means this. So I always find it very interesting to participate in these book discussion groups, and I say, don't hold back. I really want to know your comments, your questions. And, you know, people, it's like a Rorschach test. They see different things. They, oh, well, I thought this. Well, I didn't think that at all. In fact, some of them said, well, I thought this about Walter and Alan. I said, you know, you should have been in my writer's group. No one brought that up, and I never thought about it.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting how everyone comes from a different viewing point and reads a novel differently.
Right, And just as long as they aren't shy about telling you, you know, because I say, don't feel you'll be laughed at by me. I hope your group won't laugh at you.
Kay, it's been great talking with you today. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Well, it's been wonderful talking with you.
Well, good. Do you have any final thoughts you want to share?
Well, I don't. I guess I just hope that more in the book really builds by word of mouth. We found that, like with One Last Dance, that my sister and I finished the book of my dad's, it usually takes 3 to 5 years, no matter what kind of, I guess, PR you have about it, or just to build by word of mouth. You can have 5 items in 5 different papers, and the same person can be reading it 5 times, and finally, after the 5th one, may say, I think I've heard of that book. So,
yes.
We really hope that word of mouth can carry Butcher of Dreams, like finally I think it's starting to do with One Last Dance.
Well, I hope to have you back soon so we can talk about One Last Dance. It sounds like a great, great book. And I think it's an award-winning novel as well, right?
Yes, yes it is.
Congratulations.
Well, thank you very much. It's really been a pleasure.
Oh, thank you so much, Kay. You take care.
You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, listeners, there we go. I've been talking with Kay Williams, co-author of Butcher of Dreams. She wrote this book with her longtime friend, Eileen Wyman. So the website, Calliope Press, CalliopePress.com, can be bought through local and online booksellers as well. There's links from her website to purchase the book. So once again, thank you so much for listening to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.